Okay, good evening. I think it's time to continue with our Bauhaus lecture series, and welcome to the second season of this very special series, already started in October 2018, and which is organized by the CCSA. My name is Carsten Ruhl. I'm professor for architectural history at the art history department at Goethe University, and I'm only part of, let's say, a cooperation called the Center for Critical Studies in Architecture, which is organizing this lecture series. But what is the Center of Critical Studies in Architecture? It's basically a cooperation between the German Architecture Museum, the Art History Department here in Frankfurt, and the Architectural Faculty in Darmstadt. And I think it's time to say that I'm very grateful for this cooperation, because we have so many possibilities in setting up new structures, fostering architectural research in many different ways. And you might know that it's not, let's say, natural that that we have this combination between architectural research done by an art history institute or art history department by architects and by a museum. So what we have here in this cooperation are otherwise very separated cultures of architecture research, and what we are trying to do is to bring them together and open up space for new perspectives on architecture. And I'm very happy that we already had a lot of very exciting events in this context. I just mentioned a few. A very interesting exhibition on the Max Becher files kept in the archive of the German Architecture Museum, and also a very interesting and very dynamic, in a sense, conference entitled "Who is in Charge of Architecture?" And of course, our Master and PhD colloquia and a lecture, two lecture series. We already started in 2017 with the lecture Architecture System Order, and we continued this format with our Bauhaus lecture series comprising two semesters. So what are the goals of the Bauhaus lecture series? I think you all might know that on the occasion of the centenary of the Bauhaus, we have plenty of events dedicated to this legendary institution, or sometimes it is mentioned as a school. But our idea was to, give space to a different perspective on this phenomenon, not being part of the program Bauhaus 100, but rather to say that we are trying to organize a very autonomous lecture series separated from the official program, which is dealing with so many cliches on the Bauhaus and well-known historical narratives. We all know that they are in many senses problematic, and I think it's time to see in a very different manner on this very, important chapter of modern architecture in the 20th century, especially in Germany. So the first season of this lecture series had a quite, broad panorama, departing from critical theory and its perspective on the reception of the Bauhaus in the post-war era. That means after 1945, following up by reflections on the reception of the Bauhaus in the West, and also in the Soviet Union and the GDR, and of course the reception of the Bauhaus in different writings of well-known authors like Manfredo Tafuri and Giulio Carlo Agam, that means the reception of the Bauhaus in Italy after World War II. And this first chapter, or this first section, ended up with the history of this institution we are in now, the German Architecture Museum, and its founding director, Heinrich Klotz, who had a very specific perspective on modernity in architecture, being concerned with contemporary architecture, postmodern architecture, and very much criticizing from this background modern architecture and functionalism in a more general way. So what we are going to do with the second season is to broaden the perspective on one side by going back to archival sources. That is one goal of the second season of the Bauhaus lectures, but also being concerned with networks, the institutionalization of modern architecture, and the significance of the Bauhaus for architectural practice today. And maybe at the end, we are confronted with the fact that the Bauhaus, or the Bauhauses, never existed as we know it. So that might be one important insight into the whole history and the reception, the history of the reception of the Bauhaus. Against this background, we are very happy that Hilde Heinen accepted our invitation for the opening lecture of the second season. She's one of the leading scholars in modern architecture theory and a widely known critic of its mainstream narratives and its cliches. Hilde Heinen is a professor of architecture theory at the University of Leuven in Belgium. She studied architecture and philosophy at the University of Leuven, where she also received her PhD. Afterwards, she was a Getty postdoctoral fellow, a research fellow at the Radcliffe Institute in Harvard, and held visiting positions at MIT and the AA School, but also in Melbourne and Harvard. Her work was supported by grants from the Research Foundation Flanders, the Research Council of the University of Leuven, the Netherlands Architecture Fund, the Graham Foundation, and so forth. Generally spoken, Hilde Heinen's research focuses on issues of modernity, modernism, and gender in architecture. I only mention publications, some publications you might know and which are really important for a deeper understanding of modernism and its critique. In Architecture and Modernity, a Critique, published in 1999, she investigated the relationship between architecture, modernity, and dwelling, arguing that critical theories, such as those of Walter Benjamin and Theodor Adorno, offer crucial insights when revisiting the modern movement. And it would have been interesting to see how Hilde Heinen would have discussed the issue with Frederick Schwarz, who gave the opening lecture of the first lesson. More recently, she is engaged with the intersection between architecture and gender studies, resulting in the volume Negotiating Domesticity, Spatial Productions of Gender in Modern Architecture. And she was also the co-editor of Back from Utopia, The Challenge of the Modern Movement, and the handbook Architecture Theory. Currently, there's a forthcoming intellectual biography of Sybil Mohoyn-Notch, which in great parts, I suppose, is also a critique on certain Bauhaus narratives. In our lecture tonight, Hilde Heinen will give an overview of recent feminist historiography, raising the question whether a general reappraisal of the Bauhaus is not in order rather than a critical celebration of its centenary. The title, or the provocative title, of this lecture is Time's Up for the Bauhaus, Reconsidering a legacy. Please welcome with me Hilde Heine.
Okay, thank you very much for this kind introduction. I indeed chose a provocative title. I'm not sure whether the lecture will completely live up to what I promised, but I will try to put some elements on the table that we can further discuss. So thank you very much for the invitation. It was a good opportunity to articulate my thoughts on this. I did not get as far as I would have hoped, but okay, we'll see where we arrive. Intro number one. I don't know whether you have here in Germany this discussion. We have it in Flanders and in many different places. Because of the documentary Leaving Neverland, has it been on German television already?
In the cinema.
So in Flanders, we have this discussion in the newspapers. Should we still listen to Michael Jackson? Because of what we now all assume that he did, or most of us assume that he abused these children. The discussion on how to interconnect the human qualities of famous people, celebrities, artists, authors, musicians. Should we disconnect the value of their works from the people, from the human qualities of the person behind the works? Yes or no? That's an important discussion going on in Flanders because of this. The idea is if you would indeed take the position that we stop playing Michael Jackson's music, then maybe, if you would be consistent and consequent, maybe you should also not show the Bauhaus anymore. Maybe the abuse was not that outspoken in the Bauhaus, but still. So let's leave this as a kind of starting thing, more important introduction. Why is it, I've been puzzling about this, why is it that modernism and feminism are not seen as bedfellows, as things that really go together? I should explain that my use of the terms modernity, modernism, modernization, but especially modernity and modernism goes back to Marshall Berman. And I know that the translation in German is not, it presents difficulties. It's die moderne, I think, is something between modernity and modernism. But we can discuss that. Anyhow, if you apply the ideas of Marshall Berman, that means that modernity is a condition that you experience, a condition that is the alternative to a condition of tradition. That's modernity. Modernization is the socio-economic process that leads up to modernity. And modernism is, in his writings, in his definition, modernism is the body of tendencies and movements, all of them that say yes to modernity, that celebrate and embrace modernity. In the book, the famous book, All That Is Solid Melts Into Air, which is a quote of Marx, All That Is Solid Melts Into Air, that's how Marx describes the experience of modernity. Marshall Berman gives these definitions, and he himself describes modernity by analyzing the discourses of people like, indeed, Marx, Goethe, Baudelaire, some Russian authors, etc. But if you apply his definition, then you should assume that feminism is part of modernism, no? Because being modern today means also, at least that's what we tell ourselves, really subscribing to the equality between men and women. That's a hallmark of modernity, of Western modernity. So if that is really so, if being modern means believing in the equality between men and women, then feminism should logically be part of modernism, which historically is not really the case. So that's my starting point, and maybe more relevant than the Michael Jackson thing. This is well known, 1989, guerrilla girls, the women have to be naked to get into the Metropolitan Museum. 4% at that moment of the artists were women, and 76% of the nudes were women. The figures are slightly better, I'm unhappy to say. We are 30 years along. They are slightly better, but not spectacularly better. So still, it's, if you want to be in the museum, you better pose as a nude than be active as an artist yourself. How come that in art, in the visual arts, in literature, in architecture also, how come that there are so many more famous male artists and writers and architects than men, than female ones? How come? For the visual arts, the MoMA did recently a book and an exhibition on modern women. And they found that historically there were many, many, many women modernist artists. Many, many, as many women as men. Still, they are not very well known. They are not in the musea. They are not in the collections. They are not in the exhibitions. So Griselda Pollock has tried to address this puzzling paradox. And she names a series of reasons, which also has to do with the masculine establishment, who is in charge, usually men, and they are in control of the discourse and the evaluation of art, and they shape the whole discipline and practice in their own image. Hence, artists cannot be women and perform the function of being a hero. If women do enter the profession, they have to kind of transform themselves, become intellectual transvestites by identifying themselves with masculinity, the only ideal. So apparently, according to Pollock, the value system, the criteria with which we assess artworks are very much inspired by the very idea that it's men who produce the most valuable artworks. Similarly for literature, also the many, many women writers you have in the beginning of the 20th century, really many. But Bonnie Kaim-Scott explained that modernism as we were taught it at mid-century, the 50s, the 60s, really was without women or quasi without women. The inscriptions of mothers and women, and more broadly of sexuality and gender, were not adequately decoded, if detected at all. This is an example, she called it, of the politics of gender. Both the authors of the original manifestos and the literary historians of modernism took as their norm the small set of its male participants who were quoted, anthologized, taught, consecrated as geniuses. So that you can analyze in the visual art, the fields of visual arts and literature. What about architecture then? It's a bit more difficult because in architecture you cannot claim that there were many, many, many female architects. You cannot really claim that. Sociologically, that's it's a different situation. But a lot of the arguments formulated by Pollock and Kaim-Scott might also apply to architecture. So let's have a look at these three things that I will talk about: women and gender at the Bauhaus, the historiography of the Bauhaus, and the gender of genius, and then an alternative voice, Sybil Mahoney-Notch. Women and Gender at the Bauhaus. I must say I was taught, like Bonnie Kaim Scott, about modernism in architecture, no women to remember when I was a student and I was taught architectural history. I was taught about the Bauhaus, absolutely, but it was the story of Gropius and Mies and Breuer and maybe somebody mentioned Gunther Schuchel, and maybe somebody mentioned Marianne Brandt, but then you knew already a lot if you would know these two names. Moholy Nagy, Eaton, etc. Yeah, they were the heroes. These women were clearly in a kind of subordinate position, not much talked about. So you can imagine my surprise when I first learned that half of the students of the Bauhaus, or even more than half of the students at the Bauhaus the first year, were women. For me it was like, I thought we were the first generation of women, female students in architecture. We were not. But it felt as if we were, because in the history, it was in the architectural history, nobody talked about it. So the last 30 years, fortunately, a lot of scholarship has been devoted to bringing out the contribution of women at the Bauhaus. And I think that you might have heard some of the authors, Kathleen James Chakrabarty, for example, has certainly been active also in this field. And I understood that she gave a lecture here. The work that has been done, I read, for example, Isabelle Bauer's PhD dissertation, which is about Tessinov scholars, female women, women students of Tessinov and women students of the Bauhaus. And she does a kind of collective biographies of where all these women who were graduates from these two schools, and there were many, where they went and how they ended up. And it's all these stories are very, very sad stories of how they were not able to really practice architecture. If they were able for a couple of years to practice architecture, for example, together with their husband, then their husband died, and as a widow, they were not capable of keeping the office running. This kind of stories. I will talk about how come these stories were left out. But let's look at a couple of these stories. You might know them already. Then I'm sorry for doubling what earlier speakers told you. Gunther Schuchel, of course, best known because she was a female Meister at the Bauhaus. She was born in 1897, passed away in 1983, was in the Bauhaus for 11 years between 1920 and 1931, was fired by Mies van der Rohe for political reasons, lived in Zurich afterwards, where she had a rather modest career, one can say. She continued to practice, to be in textile design and but she did not have major exhibitions or whatever. She was very important in establishing the weaving class as a separate class and as a female, as the domain of the women at the Bauhaus. And she collaborated, for example, a lot with Marcel Breuer. The chair that you see on the right-hand side is jointly authored by Breuer and Stolz. And it's part of this fascinating small publication of by Breuer, who calls himself not the author of this thing, but the operator of the film. The author is Life, thus Life, which claims its rights, but he is the operator. The first two chairs are produced or designed in collaboration with Gunther Schuchel. The third one I'm not sure about, the fourth one neither. The one of 1925, the Vasily chair, is also, there was also some collaboration going on, and I find it very interesting that the last image with the woman without a chair, which apparently is where this whole evolution is going to. I have made an analysis of this, or well, not an analysis, a commentary on this this thing, this Bauhaus film by Breuer, pointing out that for me it's you can read a lot of stuff in this. And I mentioned that, and I think that's still very important in talking about the Bauhaus, that you can see three lines of development here. If you only look at chair 1 to 4, I think you see the line Bauhaus to IKEA. And the fourth one is not an iconic Breuer chair, but one that you can imagine being produced by IKEA. So Bauhaus indeed was, I think, a kind of a predecessor for what IKEA did much later with producing affordable, modern furniture, mass produced. Of course, otherwise it's not affordable. That's one line, Bauhaus, IKEA. If you look at 1 to 5, you see another line, Bauhaus Vitra. Now, I'm not sure whether you can, whether you are already, well, rich enough to afford Vitra chairs, but this one is, by the way, it's not really the Vitra one, it's produced by Knoll International. Vitra only has the small ones, but even the small ones are, so the mini version of this, which you can display on a table or something, is 280 euros, so not really affordable. So line 1, Bauhaus IKEA, line 2, Bauhaus Vitra, line 3, Bauhaus Cyborgs, I think. But that's the line that has not been drawn out. This woman is sitting there. I'm wondering, is this the emancipation, the anticipation, is this last image the anticipation of the post-humanist vision articulated 60 years later in 85 by Donna Haraway, American theorist, who talks about cyborgs as the future of feminists and women and post-humanism. Is this the announcement of a new future in which boundaries between nature, human, and machine are transgressed? Perhaps, I'm claiming, perhaps without consciously realizing it, I think without consciously realizing it, Breuer might have left us here with a promise of a future in which the discriminatory gender policies of the Bauhaus somehow made way for the emergence of hybrid, contradictory, fractured entities that realize the original Bauhaus ambitions in unexpected and feminist ways. Question mark. But I find it very interesting, this woman hovering in midair without a chair to support her. And I suggest that she has an exoskeleton like a cyborg might have. Okay. But yeah, Breuer, of course, went on to the United States. His name was made afterwards. He became this very important architect, many monuments built, etc. But Stölzl lived this quiet life in Switzerland. Not many people heard from her. These were the Bauhaus weavers. Elisabeth Oestrache, Gertrude Preziwerk, Lena Berger, Grete Reichardt, Lotte Bezi, Annie Albers, Ljuba Monstrinsky, Rosa Berger, Gunther Stölzl, Otti Berger, Kurt Wanke. The photo is by T. Lux Feininger. So the weaving class was mostly the domain of the women, although Kurt Wanken is also there, so it's not really exclusively women. And the one who really made a career the only one I would claim of all of this group was Annie Albers. Annie Albers was the only one of the Bauhaus women who managed to get away to emigrate to the United States together with Josef Albers. She really could build there upon her experience from the Bauhaus, teaching textile design in Black Mountain College, developing very important theories about weaving and what is weaving. She elaborated further on what Günther Stürzel already and Otti Berger had begun. And she had recently, as you might know, a one-woman exhibition in Tate Modern in London. So then you have made it if you have gotten there. Marianne Brandt, one of the most talented designers of the Bauhaus, I guess. A photographer, striking self-portraits, a photographer. She was in the Bauhaus from 1924 to 1929. And after the Second World War, she lived in East Germany, again losing a job. Immediately after the Bauhaus, she landed a job in an industrial plant as a designer, an industrial designer, but she had to leave after a couple of years because it was increasingly difficult as a woman to hold a job like that. She lived in East Germany after the war, so that was not a condition where a lot of people would have been celebrating her for being a part of the Bauhaus. So not much was, she did not have many career opportunities afterwards. Elisabeth Otto has been working on Marianne Brandt and her photo montages, comparing them with Laszlo Moholy-Nagy, with the work of Laszlo Moholy-Nagy, and finding that Marianne Brandt indeed was very, very gifted and has made work that is absolutely very interesting and engaging and also critical. She, of course, is best known for this type of work in the metal workshop. So it's only the last, I think it's only 10 years or something that we know about her photomontages. It's not that long that they have become available in the archives. But this we knew all along, how she, as a designer, made this type of objects in the metal workshop. Lotte Stambeze. This was the story that I first came across because a book was made on her and her work in the late 80s, I think, in the Netherlands. And this, I don't know whether I should call it a typical story, but it's an instructive story. Lotte Beese, born 1903, passed away in 1988, was in the Bauhaus from 1926, 1928. Had the bad luck, I think, to fall in love with Hannes Meyer, which I understand very well. Very attractive guy. I don't blame her, absolutely not. What happened then? They had an affair. Hannes Meyer was married. They still had an affair. That happens in life. Nowadays, the professor might be in serious trouble seducing a student. Can you imagine? Well, it happens all the time, of course. But nowadays, professors get in trouble if they seduce students. Back then, Hannes Meyer stayed on, she had to go. So she never finished, graduated from the Bauhaus. She had jobs in the office of Hannes Meyer in Berlin. She went to Moscow with the Ernst Mayr Brigade, if I'm not mistaken. She went to Brno. She became pregnant again by when the affair with Meyer was rekindled. That was not during the Bauhaus period, but afterwards. So they had a child, Peter Meyer, who was recognized by Hannes Meyer, but born out of wedlock, which made her a single mother, really. She went back to the Soviet Union, married Mart Stam, moved with him to the Netherlands, got finally her degree there in 1945, which was great. At least now she was an architect. And she did then, afterwards, she became the head of the urban planning office in Rotterdam. So I was wrong in saying that only Annie Albers had a major career. Lotte Stambeze did also very well, considering all that happened in her life. So she was the head of the urban planning office in Rotterdam, 46 to 68. So you can say that her career, because of this affair with Hannes Meyer and what followed, that she had to postpone getting her degree with at least 15 years. But she got there. But this was the first time that I came across a story of a woman at the Bauhaus and what had happened to her. And the thing is that many of those women went to stories like this. I'm not saying becoming single mothers, etc., but taking on family responsibilities, helping out the men in their lives and helping out so much that they forgot about making a career for themselves. That's what usually happened. Okay, Lucia Moholy. She was a bit older than Laszlo Moholy, Moholy Nagy. These are photographs by Lucia Moholy, 1894. She was born 1989. She passed away. She had, in fact, not really an official role at the Bauhaus, but she was there together with Laszlo Moholy Nagy from 1923 onwards, and Laszlo left the Bauhaus in 1928, and then they separated. So she had been around quite a lot and took a lot of photos, which turned out to be very important afterwards, because she was more than Laszlo Moholy Nagy and other photographers in the Bauhaus. She was a very Neusachlichkeit photographer. That was her style. So she really was documenting things more than using these special angles and special perspectives that Laszlo, for example, did. So her work was really documentary, recording, and very important in that respect. Afterwards, she lived first in Berlin, then in London, then in Switzerland also. And I'll come back to her story, I think. These are other of her photos of the Bauhaus, very important photos. The right-hand one specifically, I'll talk about that a bit more. Photos from her, she documented the Meisterhauser in Dessau, and of course the interior of her own dwelling, and the other Meisterhauser also in, this is where she lived with Laszlo Moholy Nagy. Ise Gropius, photographed by Lucia Moholy. The other image is, we are not sure, or at least that's what I find in the literature, that it's not completely clear who is the woman on in the left-hand photo, unidentified woman on Breuer's Vasily chair, 26. It might be Ise Gropius. Another possibility is Liz Beyer. Ise Gropius, 1897 to 1983, maybe not an important. She was the sister of Ellen Frank. She was born as Ise Frank, sister of Ellen Frank. Ellen Frank was the companion of Laszlo Moholy Nagy when Laszlo was in between wives, between Lucia and Sybil. Ise was the second wife of Walter Gropius. And Hans was present at the Bauhaus from 23 to 28, afterwards Berlin, London, and Boston with Gropius. Their marriage lasted. Okay, you see, and this is the both of them in Berlin, you see that Gropius is, I think, 14 years older than she is. She was an aspiring writer and journalist, and she came to Weimar, to the Bauhaus exhibition in Weimar in 1923, to report on what was going on this exciting new art movements, and that's how her relationship with Gropius intensified. And Gropius, in fact, told her, "I need you," and married her. And in fact, her role was to write about the Bauhaus and to edit Gropius's writings or lectures. It's claimed that she wrote, in fact, many of Gropius's lectures and articles. Again, nowadays, we would find that unacceptable. If one of you students write a paper for a fellow student, even if it's your boyfriend, this is not acceptable. Boyfriend should do it himself, right? All the way around, the same thing. Eh? Boyfriends do not write papers for girlfriends. But Ise Gropius wrote articles for Walter, usually without being named as the editor, the author, the co-author, or whatever. So these are the stories that are there, that now the last 30 years have been unearthed, that we now become familiar with, and that, well, to a person like myself are, to be honest, painful. I am uneasy about this. Uneasy about the historiography. About the fact that they were absent for so long. Let's talk a bit about historiography and the gender of genius. Walter Gropius, well, if you think about the impact, the huge impact of the Bauhaus worldwide, it has to do with several of these important masters going to the United States, establishing a reputation for themselves, and from there impacting the image of the Bauhaus that grew and grew and grew and grew. Walter Gropius went to Harvard University. Laszlo Moholy-Nagy established the Institute of Design in Chicago. Mies van der Rohe was at IIT in Chicago. Marcel Breuer, Ludwig Hilbersamel, Josef Albers, and others all could go to the States and land good jobs there. Good jobs to very good jobs. And from there, especially Gropius had a serious handle on how to present and to craft really the image of the Bauhaus. That was already going on in Europe when we were still in the years 1990 to 1933, because of the Bauhaus books that were published by Gropius and Moholy-Nagy. They had a huge impact, so it was not just producing artworks, it was also artworks and projects and graphic and exhibitions and you name it, all the work of the Bauhaus. It was not just doing that work, it was also writing about it, making sure that there was a discourse, that it made waves. And Gropius continued to do that when he arrived in the United States. In 1938, already there was a first Bauhaus show in the Museum of Modern Art in New York, a catalog edited by Walter Gropius, Herbert Bayer, and Ise Gropius. In that catalog, apparently she was mentioned as an editor. And using, as Gropius tended to do, a lot of the material of Lucia Moholy. There was this whole thing about Lucia Moholy's negatives. That's, again, a very, very sad story. You would rather do not know it, but, well, it happened. So Lucia Moholy, the one who did all these photographs that became famous afterwards, had to leave Berlin in a hurry. Her new partner was a communist party member. They lived together in her apartment, and he was captured by the Nazis. And so she had to leave because, of course, she could be the next person to be taken. She had to leave in a hurry, only taking one suitcase with her. And she left all her possessions in the care of Laszlo Moholy-Nagy, her ex-husband. At that moment, not officially ex, her husband at that moment. Laszlo Moholy-Nagy at that moment was already together with Sybil Moholy-Nagy, who was then his handmaiden and who took, in fact, care of all the practicalities regarding these things. Laszlo and Sybil also moved out of Berlin. The negatives of Lucia Moholy-Nagy were with them, and they brought him to the house of Walter Gropius, which supposedly was a safe haven. From there, they apparently were shipped to the United States, or at least part of that material. But Gropius kind of used it there, never told Lucia that he had them, and it's only years later that she found out that he had them and was using them. Then she kind of sued him for not mentioning her name, not giving her copyrights, things like that. She claimed them back. In the end, she got back copies, and the originals are in Berlin in the Bauhaus archive. So again, and this part was part of the reason that Lucia's career also kind of petered out in the 50s, 60s, or at least that's how she felt about it. Okay, Ise wanted to also in the United States, she hoped to continue her fledgling career as a writer in the United States, but that didn't work out. She submitted an article to the Atlantic Monthly, which is an important intellectual cultural magazine in the United States. That article was entitled "Grandma was a career woman and a career girl," so that means that she also looked behind her and saw that she was not the first wanting to make a career. That there was this prehistory of women emancipating themselves. And so she advocated for allowing women into the workplace, but the Atlantic Monthly did not want that article, and they wrote back to her that this was unheard of, that they would never publish such an argument, and they really derided her and her argument. So Ise was very much taken aback by that, and from then onwards she did not write under her own name any longer, but she did continue to write in the house she served with Walter Gropius in Lincoln, Massachusetts. Sorry, it's not Lincoln, Cambridge. It's Lincoln, Massachusetts. It's a town a little bit away from Cambridge. And so she continued editing Walter's articles, working very hard to that end, but not writing under her own name any longer. Here is again one of the photos of Lucia Moholy-Nagy, or Lucia Moholy, as she sometimes called herself, used by Siegfried Gideon in the 1941 Space, Time and Architecture, which was like the Bible for the modern movement. Gideon did a fantastic thing there, really historicizing the whole modern movement, claiming that it was the heir to a lot of things that had been going on before, and putting center stage Gropius, Mies, Le Corbusier, and saying that the architecture of Gropius, especially in the Bauhaus, kind of embodied space-time in the same way that the cubism of Picasso, L'Arlésienne, he published them side by side, had done that with layering and interpenetration and different perspectives overlaid, etc. And the fact that you see a car there going under the bridge building of the Bauhaus was very important for his argument, because it suggests dynamism and movement, just as the different layers of L'Arlésienne, etc. So you see here again Gideon writing the history of the Bauhaus using Moholy-Nagy's pictures. He did credit her, at least in the later editions that I saw. But that does not really mention a lot about the role of women in the Bauhaus. And he, of course, was invited by Gropius to Harvard, etc. So it's this old boys network at work. Another old boy comes in, Hans Winkler, in 1962. He publishes what amounts to the first standard work on the Bauhaus, being supported by Gropius and Mies van der Rohe. He is the one who started the Bauhaus archive in Berlin, which now holds Lucia Moholy's negatives. And this is the book that established for a whole generation, for my generation, the image of what is the Bauhaus about. And so it was about a lot of things, but it was not about women and their career objectives. In works like these, 1965, 1970, this male perspective continues to dominate, few women around who are being heard, and that is totally consistent with the discourse of genius. I think it's important to realize that the way we understand art, literature, architecture, but also science, we unconsciously almost, except when you read Kristin Battersby's book, then it's not so unconscious anymore. But if you look at the internet for genius, and who is a genius in literature, and a genius in art, and a genius in this, and a genius in that, you will find around 90% names of men. That's not a coincidence. That's because the notion of genius, she argues, goes back to Greek antiquity, was defined as male, linking divinity with male procreativity. So genius, and it's a notion that comes up since Romanticism in Western art, and is usually seen as a male artist who is in touch with his feminine side. That's the real genius, also the scientist. He needs to have a little bit of intuition, you know. Just being cold and rational doesn't do the job. You need to have a bit of feminine sensitivity to be a real genius. But you need to be a man too. So the other way around, it doesn't work. A woman who is in touch with her male side is a bit of a weird and failed woman. She does not qualify as genius. In the discourse of Romanticism, which is a 19th century discourse, but we inherited that discourse and we continue to use it. I have a bit of an excursus. I will do this very rapidly. I did in 2012 an analysis of the Pritzker Prize winners. These are our architectural geniuses. And since 1979, these prizes given more or less annually, and there are only, well, very few women. By now, I think there are three, Zaha Hadid and Kazuo Sejima, and then 2 years ago, there was this Barcelona office, which had one of the three partners was a woman. But you see very few women. And that has to do with, there are not so many women in architecture, maybe true, but also with how, what is mentioned as the jury by, as values, as qualities that they want to recognize in the work of an architect. And these are the kind of qualities that are popular with juries. And if you start analyzing them according to gender, from a gender perspective, you see that there are many more masculine qualities than feminine qualities that are brought up by the juries, and that indeed the best formula for getting yourself a Pritzker Prize is if you mix 3-1 male and masculine and feminine qualities in your architecture. Note that Zaha Hadid, who is the only woman who had the prize as herself, was 4 times masculine qualities. So that's the avant-garde, heroic avant-garde model. So if you are a woman, it's good to be more masculine than the man. Then it might work. Okay. So why is it that we evaluate, how is our value system in architecture gendered? The concept of the genius is gendered, as Kristin Battersby analyzes very convincingly. The concept of authorship is also gendered. I can say more about that, but I have a lot of arguments to support that claim. Of course, there is also the construction site ethos. Architects have to deal with construction workers, and they are not nice people. So a lot of fathers tell their daughters not to go for architecture because why don't they do interior architecture, you know? That's much more suitable for a woman. Culture of self-promotion, tough competition. Of course, you need to be totally devoted to architecture, work all hours of the night and day. And absolutely self-promote your work if you imagine or if you allow the thought that maybe somebody else's work is better than yours, you can forget it. And the masculine values are more. So all of this together works to the end that indeed in architecture our system of, we have a system of heroes. Our SAR system is a system of heroes, and we produce very, very few heroines, almost none. And that's so the historiography of the Bauhaus is continuing, or what we see there in terms of gender is continuing up to this day in, when you look at something like the Pritzker Prize. So the story repeats itself all the time. Okay. So what this scholarship has been doing, I think, at least that's what I hope it's been doing. First, setting the record straight, there were women. There were interesting women who have done very interesting work, very interesting artworks, very interesting photographies, very interesting theoretical texts. It's really, if you start looking into the work, it's really not sub-top, it's top work. So setting the record straight is one thing, challenging the mainstream historiography that kind of keeps the women out of sight, highlighting these women's stories, their contributions, but also analyzing the gender, the politics of gender. The politics of gender that, for example, made Gropius and his masters very uneasy when they saw that their first class was more women than men. And then they came up with a series of things to make sure that the next batch would be more men than women. And that's how they gradually changed the proportion of women in the school. So that's politics of gender. But Gropius appropriating Lucia Moholy's photos is also politics of gender. And most of all, I think what is important is that we start questioning these value judgments. I started this lecture with Michael Jackson, and it's far from me, well, I don't want to make the claim that if a person is a very questionable human being, you should kind of ostracize the artwork that they produce. I don't subscribe to that idea. So I do think that we have to continue to appreciate Caravaggio, although he committed a murder. But his work is there and is part of our heritage. And we should not ostracize it. At the same time, we need to, I think, really question how do we look at these works of art, how do we look at these works of architecture, when do we call a work of genius? How is it that we systematically push aside the work of women? Do not look at it, do not consider it valuable. Maybe our value system in itself is gendered and kind of gives advantages to work produced by men, like Griselda Pollock was already suggesting. I think she really has a point. Okay, my very last part, this is finally my own research. I've been working on Sybil Moholy-Nagy. who was very critical of Bauhaus modernism in the United States. In 1968, she published an article called Hitler's Revenge, and this is what she says about Bauhaus functionalism. You can read it. She thinks the fruit of German genius was poisoned, not pure and wholesome as it presented itself in the discourse of Gideon and Gropius. It was lethal, lethal harvest, the functionalism of the Bauhaus. Gropius, Mies, Breuer were the ones who spread the apple seed. Now, Sibyl Moholy-Nagy was, of course, the widow of Laszlo Moholy-Nagy. There is a whole story to her life. I will quickly go through it. Laszlo, she had, again, I don't know what to say. Did she have the good luck that Laszlo Moholy-Nagy passed away early on? Or was it bad luck? I don't know. The fact was he passed away in 1946, when he was still very young, 53 or something. She found herself with two children in Chicago. Like Ise Gropius, she was an aspiring writer. She was a bit more successful than Ise and had published a piece in the Atlantic Monthly and had a book out by then, Children's Children. She also edited Moholy's work, Vision in Motion. She was the editor because it was posthumously published. So she had at that moment, she was herself 43. She had it in her to first write the biography of Moholy. That's the 1950 book, Experiment in Totality. And then she continued on, published in English, the book by a pedagogical sketchbook by Paul Klee with an introduction by her, started teaching at Pratt Institute, published a lot in architectural journals, published other books, 57, Native Genius and Anomalous Architecture, Matrix of Man, several of her books also translated in German. And from early on, from the 50s, she started criticizing Mies van der Rohe, which is maybe not so strange because Mies and Laszlo and Moholy-Nagy in Chicago, they were quite hostile towards one another. So she continued the hostility from the 50s onwards. But she was very good friends, in fact, with Ise and Walter Gropius, especially with Ise. So it took somewhat longer before she started criticizing Gropius. So the Lakeshore Drive apartments, she didn't think highly of them. She said they had lightless and airless bathrooms, an impossible dining base, and this transparent living quarters. She didn't believe in that. So she appreciated Frank Lloyd Wright and pitted his way of articulating living spaces to against Mises' Farnsworth House and the idea of transparency. It took a bit longer for her to take on Walter Gropius, but by 1959 she did it. And she was the first to criticize Gropius for this building, which is now the MetLife building, which went up as the Pan Am building, which in fact was a real estate development. But in order to make it more acceptable, the developer had asked Walter Gropius and Pietro Belluschi to kind of add their design skills to the thing. What they did was tapering the very, very, very squat building. They tapered it a bit so it looked slightly more elegant, or at least that's what they argued. But she didn't take it. She really blamed them for it. She blamed them for a willingness to sell out to a promoter, and also mentioned that this was a great tragedy given Gropius' own high-minded appeal to morality, his reputation among young students. This was in 59, so rather early. And according to Meredith Clausen, this was the beginning of the end of modernism. She makes a very interesting book on the Pan Am building in New York, The Shattering of the Modernist Dream, she calls it, and credits Sibyl Moholy-Nagy for first, being the first to articulate these criticisms. So in 1968, we had the Hitler's Revenge, from which I already quoted, and that was against this project, which was a project by Marcel Breuer, which would have been put right next to the Pan Am building on top of the Grand Central Station in New York. That was never built, fortunately, I think. In Matrix of Man, I think she calls for what she calls an architectural urbanity. So her criticism of modernism was really about, first, that they did not take into account the past enough. For her, history was very, very important, and the historical heritage that was embodied in the city was very important. Secondly, that they embraced science and technology to the detriment of many other things. So for her, cities are governed by Tess's agreement on multiplicity, contradictions, tenacious traditions, reckless programs, limitless tolerance for individual values, a whole series of things that she did not find in the credo, the discourse of modernists. And she also pitted, you have to read between the lines, but here and there she really is explicit about that. She makes a contrast between the masculine belief in science and technology that she thinks is being exaggerated by Bauhaus modernism, and against that she contrasts that with femininity, female values, feminine qualities. And here and there in her writings also explicitly refers to woman as the, what she calls, the hopeful obstacle, referring to goddesses of the ancient Greeks and even to Demeter, which was a Roman goddess, the goddess of fecundity, etc. So she refers to women's supremacy as the maker of the individualized environment for loving, working, learning, playing, healing. So what she does here, I think, is saying to modernism, science and technology and rationality and functionality, it's not enough. You need to have more. You need to balance these values with other things that have to do with the matrix, the architectural matrix, which is of course a gendered metaphor, nurturing generative organic forces of life, vitality. So she positions women and femininity as counterbalancing these technocratic desires for control and mastery. I think she even comes close to what later will be eco-feminist positions. She passed away too early to be aware of ecofeminism. So for me, I think Sybil Moholy-Nagy was an important critical voice in the 50s and the 60s, who tried to kind of twist and transform the value system with which we look at architecture. On the one hand, she reminded modernist architects of their roots and original ideals. She also was insistent about that. So to a large extent, she remained faithful to the ideals of Laszlo Moholy-Nagy. But she became increasingly critical, first of Mies, then of Gropius, also Le Corbusier. She had some nasty things to say about Le Corbusier too. For her, this architectural urbanity was kind of balancing out masculine and feminine forces and values, and that's where her metaphor of matrix comes from. So I'm concluding here with Sybil Moholy-Nagy because maybe this is also an effect of the politics of gender, but she was very, very much there in the discourse of the 50s and the 60s on architecture. Very much. Also here in Germany, many of her texts have been translated in German and have and she was here as a visiting lecturer, etc. But she quasi disappeared from our consciousness. So the work that I have been doing has resulted in a book manuscript where I have written an intellectual biography investigating, I think, the paradoxical relationship between modernism and feminism that I have been talking about all along through her life and work, which is indeed also her work and her life are paradoxical in this respect, because she did not self-identify as a feminist. In the 1960s, Women's Lib was ongoing. She had interesting discussions with her daughter about Women's Lib, so she absolutely did not self-identify as a feminist, but in many ways I think she lived a feminist life, enabled to a certain extent by the fact that she was early widowed. So if Laszlo Moholy-Nagy had continued to live, probably she would have continued to be his handmaiden, as her daughter called it later. But he didn't, so she had to make an independent life, or at least that's how she saw it. So she lived what I would call a feminist life, took up the defense of feminine values in architecture, and in that sense produced a kind of alternative analysis of modernism. And to me, this brings to the fore all these paradoxes and contradictory aspects of this overall interrelationship between modernism and feminism that I can still not get my head around. But I must say that studying Sybil Moholy-Nagy's life and work was informative and learned me a lot about how women were conditioned in the 20s, 30s, and even more so in the 50s and the 60s to kind of not pursue career goals, to indeed limit their roles to that of handmaidens rather than authors in their own right. And how they nevertheless, notwithstanding all these constraints, nevertheless often did a hell of a job in still producing artworks, writings, etc., etc. Thank you very much.
Talk. I'm sure there are a lot of questions or invitations, and there's already we have some time for discussion. So, is there anybody who would like to
I can add that I probably understand German if you talk slowly enough.
Okay.
Yeah.
That she was really critical when it came to Mies van der Rohe, Gropius, and the heroes of the Bauhaus movement. But what about the Bauhaus itself? Was she also critical when it came to the institution of the Bauhaus as a whole? So
no.
No?
No, because I think she was most critical of how she thought that the Bauhaus protagonists in the United States had kind of twisted and turned around what she saw as the real legacy of the Bauhaus. So there is also a very interesting article from 1965 called The Diaspora, and that's how I first came across her work, reading that article. And there she says, well, what Hitchcock and Johnson has done with the international style, they completely distorted what was in Europe seen as modern architecture. They made it into a style, and in fact at the Bauhaus they wanted to produce anything but a style, so making that into the international style was to her a total transformation. And there her analysis was, but of course Gropius, Mies and the others, they wanted to be accepted in the States, in the United States, because this was their lifeline. They were pushed out of Germany. So they accepted the international style paradigm, but it was in fact a twisting of what the real legacy might have been.
Thank you, Jitte, for this very important, it's not only an overview, but standing firm to certain positions and opening questions more than answers. I have a question for you concerning archives.
Uh-huh.
And all the materials that you've been transforming to source, such as the work from Philippe Molinacci or all the ones that you've wrote in the past. I mean, all this journey trying to trace the materials, you know, back and forth, travel materials, institutionalization of materials.
Yeah.
I have two questions. First, do you think archives also embody forms of male subjectivity?
Of?
Male subjectivity.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
How, what is your position about institutionalization of archives?
Well, yeah, that's why I mentioned Hans Winkler and Gropius and Mies and the establishment of the Bauhaus archive. It was the old boys network at work. I think, well, you see that, for example, in the archives of American art, there is a lot of material on Laszlo Moholy-Nagy and a bit of material on Sybil Moholy-Nagy. So it's like, three boxes of Sybil versus 15 boxes of Laszlo, something like that. So that's also, of course, politics of gender, but it also testifies to how women often saw themselves also as in a supporting role. It's not just that men pushed them in this, It's not like that. It's also that that often, for example, a lot of artists' widows continue to write and celebrate and push their late husbands without putting themselves in the picture. In that sense, Sybil was a bit different. She did the biography of Moholy-Nagy, and afterwards she still did things. She wrote new material for exhibition catalogs, etc., and she followed up, but her main focus was no longer on Laszlo's modernism, but on architecture. After she wrote the Experiment in Totality, but still, for example, the book has come out in Germany in I think 1969, and I think she did the translation herself. So that means that she was invested enough to spend quite some time in rewriting her own prose into another language.
But you know, just to catch up, so this is, as you claim, an extraordinary situation.
Yeah.
Most of the times, these materials are still at the margins of collections, for example. I'm wondering how you reach this type of materials. How we transform these materials into source. You know, and how to not only expect having women such as Sybil Moholy-Nagy, who was aware of things and who took the front lines.
Yeah.
But so you agree that there are still the margins.
Yeah. I don't know. We have been there was a symposium here when we had the Frau Architect exhibition, and one of the contributions there was about, that was by Ines Weizmann, I remember. She made a film about looking for lost furniture that never was found, but the film was about trying to establish these traces. And it was, if I remember correctly, Wolfgang can help me, it was, I think, a desk designed by a woman that was foldable or something like that. And they had a photo of a design drawing, and they knew that the thing had existed, but they didn't find it. Was it like that? Her mother's? Well, so.
And she reconstructed the work of her mother by looking at the things left over after her death.
But it was
a complete chaos.
Yeah.
And a wonderful movie.
Yeah, a wonderful movie. Yeah? But it was really about reconstructing traces that were barely visible and remaking the story on the basis of almost nothing. Yeah.
To give us some hope, do you think that there that something changed regarding architectural historians today, or would you say that it's almost like the great heroic narratives of modernity? I'm just wondering because last year Eric Bechtel published his new book on Marcel Breuer. And also in this case, he's once again reviving the genius. And he's saying that Marcel Breuer was a kind of, not so much a romantic genius, but a bureaucratic genius.
Okay.
And what does it mean? I'm not sure. But do you think that art historians or architectural historians or even art or architectural theorists are aware of the masculinity of the historical constructions, or is it just like?
I'm afraid very often they are not, and that is a bit a disappointment that we have now all this scholarship. So in the last 30 years, a lot of scholarship has been produced. So by now, scholars and teachers should be aware that there is a problem there, but I think in many, many schools and classes, it's the architectural history is taught as it used to be. So that's often the frustrating experience, I think, of people who do this kind of critical work. It's the same with people who work on from the post-colonial perspective, for example. There is so much evidence that modernism is bound up with colonialism, but we barely hear about that. It's not something that you would teach to, I do teach that to my undergraduate classes, but I'm kind of, it's not seen as a very obvious and normal thing. This is similar. And even if you try to bring in more feminine qualities, female voices, etc., you still are kind of constrained by the fact that you still have to teach the basics, and the basics in our discipline, what are the basics? So it's a conundrum. You cannot, because if you only teach what I have been saying here, my students wouldn't know about what does the building look like, and who was Gropius, and who was Breuer, and who was Moholy-Nagy. They also need to know that, Laszlo, I mean, yeah.
So that's a problem of teaching. But
that's a problem of teaching, but also it means that people can also very comfortably just continue. That's one thing. That's about art history and the discourse on in art history or in architectural history. Another thing is architectural culture, and I think also there, huge problem. And that has to do with the naturalization of masculine, of domination, but also with stupid things like in architecture. Most people, but especially men, are convinced that women more than men are responsible for their children. Now, if that is the culture in a field, no wonder that it's the men who work throughout the night stick to the deadline, and the women who go home and tend to their children. And then it's the men who get the credit and win the competition, and the women are home with their children, etc. So this story is...
Okay. So,
are still...
To be
I'm not so optimistic, no. No, not really.
And from what you said, it appears that these women went into like design and the art of textiles
yes.
and weaving and those kind of things, which
yeah.
appears still a bit traditional.
Yeah.
Rather than going into Bauhaus architecture.
Absolutely.
So my question is, from your point of view, why is that so? Were they as students already niched
yeah.
into these types of
yeah. Yeah. They were.
Or was it their choice or preference to do this?
Both. For some it was a choice. Like Günther Stötzl herself was pleased that the weaving class became the women's class. Because in that way the weavers could establish their own theory and their own things without a male meister looking over their shoulders. So she was to a certain extent pleased with that. Others like Marianne Brandt, for example, did not like at all that she would have been... and she managed to get into the metal workshop because she was recognized as a very, very gifted designer. And she kind of managed to get out of the weaving class. Architecture, not to forget, architecture only was started, I think, in the Dessau Bauhaus. So in Weimar, there was not yet an architecture section. And that was seen as the really special class, where only the very best could go, hence mostly men. So there were only a few women who managed to get into the architecture. Architecture and painting were seen as on the highest level in terms of... So you had a kind of hierarchy, and weaving definitely was at the bottom, maybe with pottery and wall painting. There was this hierarchy of disciplines, of media, and so the women were pushed towards the weaving class. But some embraced that and really were happy to be there. Yeah, of course, why not? But not all of them were happy to be there.
Yeah, thank you very much. I have a very specific question, actually. And it's about the writing of symbol.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned the metaphor of matrix.
Yeah.
Could you develop this a bit further? What is the metaphor about? And so we can understand this concept a bit better.
Okay. Matrix, if you look in the dictionary, matrix is, for example, where your nails grow from. That's matrix. So matrix is the nurturing tissue or ground from which something grows. It's clearly a feminine metaphor, referring to the womb and to nurturing and fostering and caring and all these kind of things. So when Sybil calls the city matrix of man, this is really what she means. The city makes man. Or human beings, yeah, that is what she means, and it's not only there in the title of that book, most obviously, of course, but she uses it in several places. Whereas I think it's not such a kind of often used word in English. Not in German, of course. The title of the book is Staat als Schicksal, different. So there, she doesn't use matrix. But in English, it definitely does. The matrix is also when you print something. The reverse, which makes the print, that's also a matrix. So
the negative form.
The negative form, yeah.
This is not feminist, right? Negative form? It's not like a symbol of feminism?
Yeah, it's what makes you grow. It's the thing that produces all these different prints. You have one basic matrix. And matrix comes from, well, linguistically it's clear from mater, and it has these motherly resonances.
And can I add a question? So now I understood that. And you said that she was very close to the theories of the ecofeminism.
Yes.
And I mean, the whole critique of ecofeminism says that if women would rule the world, everything would be better. There would be no war because women, they're ecologically friendly and all this kind of. So from my perspective now, because I'm not grown up at that time, for me it sounds rather strange. So I'm wondering how she developed this kind of very positive, how women were the characteristics?
No, not really. She also has pieces like the thing that I mentioned in Atlantic Monthly was called Women Are Misunderstood, and there she was very critical, especially of American women. But so she was not that kind towards women. And her point is not so much that women should take over the world, but rather that you should have a balance. That was really the idea. You have to balance out men and women, male and female qualities and characteristics. And that's the only way to really make a human environment that is nurturing and caring, as well as expedient and efficient, etc. So that was her big thing. And it's historically, it's not so strange that I make this connection with ecofeminism, because that comes up, the word appears in the early 1970s. So that's only 5-6 years after she wrote Matrix of Man. So that's not so strange. And the matrix metaphor is also used by some of these early ecofeminists.
No, I didn't mean that the link is strange, it just means...
Okay. Yeah. So I'm not suggesting that we should embrace completely the discourse of Sybil Moholy-Nagy, because I have, I'm also critical towards. There is, for example, a lot of essentialism in her discourse. So I'm rather critical about that. The point is rather that there were alternative understandings and ideas and discourses on what modernism was all about in the 50s, 60s. So you had female voices like Sybil's who said something that was not really part of that masculine canon, let's say. But what happens to Sybil is that she disappears from view. So it takes then 50 years almost before somebody like me manages to write a book about her. Whereas Laszlo Moholy-Nagy, for example, if you put together all the scholarship on him, well, that's quite different from this one book. No, it's the second book, because there is also Hannelore Rütjen-Spillmann has also written a book in German about her. It's the second one.
Okay,